ladies and gents, we got Leo Brady from Movie Critic Reviews and Scene Stealers podcast describing versatile actress known as Kyra Sedgwick, who Leo has had the honor of actually speaking to.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You're a very versatile just film analyzer, and you're all about just kind of describing what are you feeling, is this movie getting my attention and everything. Kyra is, you know, she's renowned for, you know, various theater, Broadway material, voiceovers, personal life. You know, she's married to Kevin Bacon, and her daughter Sosie has become a big star also recently. Yeah. And the TV show Closer,
right? And her son is a musician. Her son is like the lead singer and guitarist of like a heavy metal rock band, I believe.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, shoot. That is awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent in that family.
I know Kevin and his brother would do their band, but yeah, that is neat, because that's so hard to do, to just, you know, get out of the nepotism thing and then actually stroll on in and decide what exact career path you want to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and honestly, you know, that all comes from Kyra and Kevin. I mean, right? The two of them are 100% tried and true artists, right at the core of, you know, their personalities and who they are. I interviewed Sosie this past year for Smile, for her new horror film Smile that came out last year. And she is, you know, she's Darlene, and she is about as witty as you would expect. And she definitely, I think she is somebody who's a little bit timid in her process of acting, but I think she definitely is, you know, the type of person that wants to prove herself and sort of, you know, a lot of people hear about nepotism and nepo babies. And I think she is sort of in the camp of somebody who wants to prove that she is the real thing. And I actually think with Smile, she really did that. I think that's kind of a movie that is a heavy role to play. And you just see the talent showing up on the screen. And I think Kevin and Kyra have a lot to do with that.
1000%. It's what's wild is she kind of started becoming better known like late 90s, early 2000s, but before that, you know, like she was constantly working, but you know, most of it is just kind of just a lot of just obscure TV movies, PBS type material. And it's so interesting seeing how actors have been working for a while, but it takes getting to the third or even sixth stage of their career to finally, you know, everybody knows me now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, well, and it's interesting with, you know, sort of, you know, when you sort of asked me to come on your podcast, I basically was like, this is a very interesting topic. You know, like it was quite an honor for me to be able to interview Kyra. The reason why I interviewed her was because her new film, she directed a new film called Space Oddity. And
can't wait to see it.
Yeah. And it's a really, like, honestly, it is a very much a throwback, you know, to romantic comedies, but romantic films and films about family. I'm one of the few critics that I think was a bigger fan of it, where it felt like it worked, and she has Kevin in it. But I do think it's interesting. I don't think she should give up the acting side. I still think she's really great at that. And I think there's a lot of movies that we'll get to and talk about where she has proved time and again that she is legit. But I do think she has, you know, a lot of talent behind the camera too. I think there's sort of a nice throwback style of romantic films, romantic comedies. Space Oddity kind of reminded me of like the times of Steel Magnolias or Terms of Endearment, James L. Brooks movies where family is at the center, but there might be a little quirk about it to sort of keep the plot going along or make the audience laugh. So she is incredibly talented. And, you know, as I look through her filmography, there's so many things that make me say, why hasn't she even been given more opportunities to lead films? And I don't know if that's because she's comfortable in the lane that she's often been put in, or if because, you know, Hollywood tends to not give women enough opportunities and enough roles.
Yeah, I really don't know. I know she just seems to, despite making so many beautiful people lists and directing plenty of other TV movies that have been surprisingly effective, I don't know. I just feel like a lot of these theater people who become film and TV stars just kind of, they have a certain process. And if what they're given is just too generic or there's no truthfulness, I can see them being picky about scripts. Right. But you never know, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And like her early career, you know, like the early part of her career, she met Kevin on a film called Lemon Sky, which I haven't seen. And, you know, yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, it's like, again, doing this podcast is an exciting thing because it sort of puts you down a path to watch more of her movies. But the like I talked with her in my interview with her, the first time I had ever seen her in a movie, noticed her in a movie, was Born on the 4th of July, Oliver Stone.
You're right.
Oliver Stone's film. And, you know, that movie's coming up on almost... I mean, it came out in 1989. So it's like such a long time since it came out. And she is a major part of that movie. And I think that she has kind of found a way to be that type of actor in really every movie that she's in, where whether the movie is good or not is not exactly her problem, right? She always seems to shine in whether she has 5 minutes of the movie or if she's on screen for, you know, all 96 minutes.
Yeah, totally. A very careful actor is all about, hey, if my brand isn't working, then I'm not going to go that far. But yeah, she's been very meticulous and careful. And I have yet to see a role where I was like, oh, they barely used her.
Right.
Might even put her. Yeah, she, you know, outside of playing Deputy Chief Johnson on Closer, I think I just, she, 4th of July was a big one, but then yeah, Hearts and Souls, which was a big all-star cast, including Alfre Woodard, Robert Downey, was one of my sister's favorites, and that came on TV quite a lot. It was like one of the few movies with mature subject matter that you could still watch as a family, you know, where they're just dead spirits overseeing another troubled man. It was a good, very feel-good Frank Capra-esque fantasy, and she's done a lot of that, where she's pretty much kind of like her husband, just always part of an ensemble and just tries to find a way to not steal the thunder of the other performers while also contribute, you know, when it's time for cameras on her.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting. So the three movies that I checked out after you invited me so graciously to be on your show was a movie that, like, as you said, some, like, she would be on some TV movies, was a movie called Losing Chase that, that Kevin Bacon directed himself. And then the second movie that I watched, was a film directed by Barry Levinson with Al Pacino called The Humbling. And she's got, and again, she has a very brief role in this movie. And then the movie that I watched after that was a film from 2015 that she did with Bella Thorne called Big Sky. And of the three, Big Sky is the least, that is the worst of the three.
I concur. I was like so let down by that one. I was like, she's barely in it. She's giving it her all. Even Frank Grillo from Captain America and Purge is in this as one of the kidnappers.
Yeah,
both. I I've heard bad things about Bella Thorne behind the scene, but that's a story for another day.
Right.
But that's just it. Like, they were giving it their all, but seems so far like that movie has been rightfully forgotten. And I'm just like, they didn't lose any sleep over it.
Right. 100%. I mean, and honestly, her performance in Big Sky is her to a T, where all her character gets shot in the gut pretty early on. And she's asked to basically act her heart out while sitting in a front seat of a car with a bleeding gunshot wound. And she, again, her performance is fine. It's more than fine. It's quite good, but everything else around her feels like a half-baked screenplay and feels like a movie that really needed somebody to take second, third, and fourth looks at to make sure that it actually had more to it. It just didn't really have enough drama to it, honestly.
I concur. I was very let down. It was just like you say, I can see what the appeal might have been. I have no doubt it probably started much like Losing Chase. Losing Chase kind of works. It was like a Showtime original movie.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's going to listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Okay.
And it just showed a troubled, love triangle, and she's playing alongside Beau Bridges and Helen Mirren. When Big Sky comes along, it just feels like, okay, maybe it was kind of a stage play equivalent, but investors and everything wanted to focus more on cheap frills and the other stars. And it's like,
right,
not the best method. She's done some other movies and TV. I saw that she had been on like a canceled news radio sitcom. She had a brief recurring role in Queen Supreme, which I had seen parts of, and I recall that being very funny. It had Kristen Johnson from Third Rock from the Sun and Oliver Platt. It's basically just showing all these different judges, and it's got West Wing kind of humor. But
oh, awesome.
She's been in so many other movies that people forget she's in. Like, she was in Something the Lord Made with Omar Epps and Alan Rickman, Phenomenon with John Travolta, Man on a Ledge, was kind of one of her first movies once The Closer ended.
right. Yeah. And I talked to her too about like sort of the collection of directors in my interview, which viewers can see on amovieguy.com. It's also on amovieguy.com's YouTube page. But I talked to her about a lot of those directors she's worked with, and one of them was Sidney Lumet. She was in Sidney Lumet's Critical Care, which Yeah, it doesn't have bad reviews really, and you know that she has sort of grown along with old Hollywood. She's almost a bridge between old Hollywood, current, like her time of Hollywood and Hollywood today, because she's, I mean, God, she does have this like really long arching career. I talked to her about working with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward in Mr. and Mrs. Bridges. I talked to her about working with Oliver Stone and working with Sidney Lumet. And, you know, and then she sort of makes a transition and hits her sort of peak with The Closer, right? I mean, everybody would probably say that that's what she is known the most for. It's what she won an Emmy for.
That on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she basically parodies that B-roll.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. Because so she's been on like Brooklyn Nine-Nine and she was in The Edge of 17. And these are like really current and great sort of outlets that highlight her again, right? I mean, she is...
Yeah.
She at this point, she's just showing that like she could, she's timeless at this point.
1,000%. And I'm sure she's probably worked with her husband even more times now that, you know, he's done some directing and she's doing some TV directing also. Her episode of Ray Donovan that she helmed actually was probably the most visual of that particular season. But yeah, I was trying to do some homework on how she got that gig. And I was like, okay, well, I saw that she worked with some of the other cast and crew on other obscurities and short films. So I'm sure they eventually rang her phone number and said, hey, we want our friend to direct this episode.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, she does have some really cool collection of television that she has done. Grace and Frankie, which is like a huge hit. Ray Donovan, as you said, in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I mean... That is sort of, again, television is not my bread and butter. Where I typically live is I'm watching movies all the time. So I sort of find myself not having time for television. But, you know, I have friends who swear by Ray Donovan. I have friends who swear by Brooklyn Nine-Nine and say that's one of the funniest TV shows to come around in a while. So she is...
Actor turned TV director either, because like I'll see plenty of other people like Jonathan Franks or Peter Weller or even Lou Diamond Phillips, they'll direct a show, but it's often because, you know, they're doing 2 to 4 episodes because they're already in a recurring role, it's just easier to help out, or they were hired as director and then they were getting along so well that everyone's like, hey, we need an extra lawyer or dad, so you got the part also.
Right.
It's so wild how people can interject. And I think she's just said, you know, hey, if it's a effective TNT or NBC show, I'm going to help people out with it. But yeah, no, on the movies, she worked also with husband Kevin on Murder in the First, as well as The Woodsman, and both completely unrecognizable, you know. Anyone else would have probably freaked out or been like, how do I play that? And she's pretty much like many of these actors. She just wants you to make sure you understand the character better instead of dividing the audience or getting into politics. Her latest shows kind of bummed me out because like she was on a laugh track sitcom called Call Your Mother. And then she was on a thriller called 10 Days in the Valley.
Okay.
And unfortunately, neither really took off and they both got canceled. And I was just kind of like, I see why she was interested. I wondered what happened in the editing room on either of those. But to your point, she's got plenty of other recent stuff to dissect. Just a Kiss was this other romantic comedy that I often would find playing on HBO. And Villains is a very amusing dark comedy she did with Jeffrey Donovan from Burn Notice and Sicario.
And I actually interviewed the directors of that film as well. And I, that is, you know, I wrote a little bit of a list of just like her notable great movies. And I actually included villains in it because that movie has, you know, that's kind of one of those underappreciated indie horror films that, that will get missed by a lot of people, but yet it has this, like, if you read the cast to anybody today, you'd be like, oh, that movie sounds awesome because it has Bill Skarsgård, who is, I mean, he is just sort of a sought out actor. He, you know, he played Pennywise. Everybody loves him from that. Micah Monroe is an actress that I've also interviewed who I think like really doesn't miss a lot. And as you said, Jeffrey Donovan, another actor who he's the type of guy, I don't know how he hasn't, and maybe I haven't checked his full resume. I don't know if he's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I don't know if Jeffrey Donovan, I don't know how he hasn't been in a Quentin Tarantino movie yet. Seems like he's like a shoe-in for a Quentin
Tarantino. I don't know either.
Yeah. So she has these, you know, really, her performance in Villains is excellent. It's like sort of outside the box. It's something that she hasn't done in quite a while. And yeah, that's a movie that, you know, for your listeners, I highly recommend.
And kudos to her for even just how she approached it. Cause like anyone else would have probably been hammy or been a little bland. And she just decided, I'm just going to act like a annoyed mama bear, like, hey, I'm holding you hostage. When are we gonna kill you? I want you out of here.
right. I remember that. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, she's an actress that finds ways to sort of change herself. The other movie that I mentioned, which was, sorry, I'm blanking again right now, which was Losing Chase. Well, as we said, it was very much a TV movie. But that's kind of one of those movies where the trio cast is like excellent, right? Bo Bridges and Helen Mirren. You would have thought like, when I first saw it available and I was like skimming through a bunch of movies that, you know, to either rent or watch before I came on the show, and Losing Chase just kind of stuck out to me because I was like, this cast has Helen Mirren. Like, this movie is about a woman who kind of like loses her mind, has a bit of a like a nervous breakdown, and when Keira Sedgwick's character is brought into this home to help take care of the kids while the mother recovers, the two of them start to almost like have a romantic interest with each other. And in 1996, you know, a movie like this isn't getting that type of attention. I think if this movie was made today, they certainly would have changed a lot of things. There's certainly a lot of parts to this that don't hold up as well. But honestly, Sedgwick is just like giving it her all. And she has this like breakdown moment in the rain yelling at Helen Mirren, which is so TV movie setting. That, you know, you're like, this, you know, she's just a really great actress, and Helen Mirren, great actress, and Beau Bridges doing a great job. So it's like, it's kind of one of those movies that your mom or, you know, somebody would watch on a lazy Sunday morning because it's just on.
Yeah. The themes are interesting, but like you say, some of the transitions are a little rough or dated. Yeah. And it's even wilder though, because like a lot of critics, when they reacted to The Closer, and despite being a popular show, it never won anything. The most it would get was accolades for acting. When coincidentally, she was often noted as, wow, you're kind of an American version of Prime Suspect, which was Helen Mirren's hit show that often aired on BBC and PBS. And instead of doing what most stars do, where they're like, no, it's nothing to do with that, you know, it's pride and joy. And she actually was like, she actually jokingly almost kind of sounded like her actual character Johnson. She's like, thank you. And she's like, yes, I absolutely was influenced by that a bit. the person who just, you know, locks eyes with you and realizes you're lying, but I'm gonna wait you out.
Yeah, no, Yeah, you have to sort of fill me in a lot on the closer. I've maybe seen like bits and pieces of episodes because maybe I was like watching one episode of Law and Order before it came on, before the closer came on after it. And did she like her character was obviously the like hard-nosed detective, right?
Totally. She was like, I'm going to be brutal, but I'm not going to be a bitch. And she was very good at just being very likable. She did her best to recreate a Georgian accent. If you like something like The Shield or Bosch, it'll definitely be intriguing to you. The crimes were well thought out, but often you can spot who the villain is, but they still would keep you in suspense. Like those last 20 to 40 minutes, like, we know you did something wrong, but why did you do it? And
right.
And she was really good at just, you know, being this CIA trained top of her class detective who, you know, she's pretty much all about just being a breather. Like she wants to get along with everybody. Half the time they'll even joke up how it's almost kind of like Homicide in some of those other shows where it's like, yeah, we don't really have much of a life. So I'm going to bring a turkey to work tonight so we can at least have some kind of Thanksgiving.
that's hilarious. Yeah. And I significantly remember she had like a real Southern twang accent. That was kind of her like calling card, right?
Yeah. The trailers were pretty cliche, but when it went into reruns, like it was on every other, like My 27 or some of those other in-between stations where they would show reruns or something like that, or Crossing Jordan. And I was like, see, this is interesting because it can apply, you know, it's going to appeal to some CSI and Law and Order guys, but then it's also going to appeal to those who want a little comedy and with some action and mystery. I'm down with it. And have it, you got freaking Raymond Cruz, you know, years before he was Tuco on Breaking Bad. And
right. Then,
Tony Dennison had a funny story on one podcast he did where he was like, yeah, we all went there that first year when it won, got nominated for, you know, best lead actress. And we're still kind of unknowns, but everyone at all the other tables, even the West Wing and Sopranos tables, acknowledged us and said, you dude, you guys, you're from Police Cab, you're from Crime Story, you're from, you
know, right.
They were all recognized enough for stuff they did 2 decades ago that they still had some fanfare. And I think that's why that was such a healthy on-set relationship everyone had. It was never, let's be bigger than any of them. And to even walk away from that show after 7 years, that was something, because the show continued for 6 more years with as major crimes. But I was cool with it because, you know, it was, you know, so many actors will just kind of be on a show until they just no longer care. And I think she knew when to press the eject button. And
yes, which again, we talked about it, how I'm not much of a television watcher. And I watched Game of Thrones, I watched Breaking Bad, I watched The Walking Dead. And like shows like Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead have burned me incredibly, like
yes,
and a lot of those times when a television show does that, it really would sort of, you know, get me to be scared to jump into another television show. And I watched The Last of Us, and I know like we're dealing with a writer's strike, so it's like there's things, and I watched Stranger Things as well, but there's nice. But there, you know, there's a lot of TV that I do watch that I can tend to be a little bit tentative going into it, because I know that there might be a chance where people aren't getting out when they should have, the show's not ending and putting a nice cap on it all.
Yeah, or they're not ever going to wrap it up and it's going to become a pretentious soap opera, and it's like, okay, well, it started out great, but that was a huge waste of acting and even explosions if you're gonna just go down this rabbit hole of bad plotting, you know. It's
right happens. yeah. Well, it's interesting to take a look. You talked about like some of the co-stars that she's worked with on that show. It's like it is a lot of its standard like television actors who know how to come in and just nail it, but also actors who have been in amazing movies or amazing television. You got Stephen Tobolowsky was in an episode, Veronica Cartwright in an episode.
Oh, those were hysterical.
But yeah, you got James Avery and, you know, even J.K. Simmons was in a couple episodes, it looks like. I mean, that's...
Oh, he was in most of the run, but yeah. He was like a guest star at first, and then they said, join the cast.
That's great. I mean, that shows that it's kind of like one of those television shows that wanted to always stay on its same plane and work with reliable actors.
And she's kind of critic proof. Like, she's done so many projects that are just like, hey, if it doesn't turn out well, you can at least understand why I chose to do that. And there's nothing more frustrating when you see a great actor, but you keep getting just confused by their roles that they pick or their movie.
This is, you know, this is a good topic to even bring up because my main review this week was Fast X, and and I'm one of the few critics, not one of the few critics. I think it is rotten right now on Rotten Tomatoes, but I am one of the critics that gave it a rotten score. And I think Brie Larson is an actress that I think has, you know, amazing potential. She's won an Oscar already. She's proven she can be a really good actor in dramas. And she has a role in this that I just was like embarrassed by. Like, it was one of those performances and parts where I'm just like, why are you even taking this at all? Like,
and I don't think they ever read the script. Same thing with Jason Momoa. Loves TV work, half and half on his movie roles. He seems like a reliable henchman or badass if you give him a better script. And then it's like, okay, yeah, but here there's really nothing to this villain. Just watching it, he's just going to play to the camera and Vin Diesel's going to take out the trash. So what's the point?
Right. Yeah. So it's like, so when I see that, and obviously we know the reason why they take it, right? Like, they obviously get big paydays for being in big blockbusters of this nature, but
it's gonna happen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and honestly, I don't fault people in that regard, obviously, but you know, I think it's important to, like you said, become critic proof, to become an actor who it's like, you can always take a role and feel like a little bit of respect and a little bit of like pride in what you gave, whether the movie turns out or the television show turns out good or not.
Exactly. If you can be bigger than the movie, there will always be forgiveness for you. If you're just looking disinterested or you have a bad work report behind the scene, and you know, don't get me wrong, tabloids are different now. They'll always be awful in the UK, but the US, at least now, we can often just figure out, okay, People Magazine, US Weekly, that's bullshit. This is a clickbait site. This site generally is good, but it has a few other just full of themselves critics in this sector. You know, it's, we're having to do a checklist of dissection, so to speak, do our own homework.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, and I know, like, honestly, the critic sphere is, you know, flooded, and there's a lot of us, and it's always sort of chaotic. And honestly, for me, writing for a movieguy.com, I mean, my hope is always just that my infectious love of cinema, my infectious love of movies, or, you know, the type of genres that I love, will, you know, rub off on the people who are reading my reviews. And that's really all that matters to me. You know, it's about sort of just being honest and, you know, telling the audiences, you know, when a movie's good or not.
1000%. Yeah. I think she's also just a natural kind of badass, just someone who's just very stern, but knows how to show affection without being weepy or over the top or melodramatic. She's clearly lived and breathed lots of emotion, knowing how to compound it together to where it's just so theatrical.
Yeah. Well, when she talked about it in my interview with her, that she's like very much a New York, you know, person. She's got that calloused, tough sort of skin that allows her to do that. And it's interesting because, like, some of her directing choices too, we talked about the television stuff, you know, she did a TV movie called Story of a Girl, and she did,
directing her daughter.
Okay. Have you seen that?
It was so good. She basically got her on-screen husband, John Tenney, to play the dad of her on-screen daughter. And she was just directing. Kevin Bacon also played in it. And he was basically a restaurant guy who's looking out for her. He's her employer. You basically felt like that was kind of what made her take off and pursue more directing, because basically she was just like, who am I comfortable around? Okay, I'm going to have my husband, going to have my daughter. I need to give her more work.
Yeah.
My sister, when Smile became so big, she went and rewatched the episodes that Susie Bacon was in.
Okay.
And that was interesting because she played her on-screen niece instead of on-screen daughter in that.
But okay.
I think she definitely, that was the blueprint where she's like, okay, my daughter's comfortable acting. I'm comfortable acting with her. Right. Let's give her an awesome lead role. And Lifetime's getting better at actually having some actual dramatic pieces instead of, you know, who's the psycho boyfriend next door. So let's put it on there. And it was just a very straightforward dramatic play, basically. She does some better ones. Like, she was in Taipan in a brief role. She was in Miss Rose White, which I think was a Hallmark movie. But despite being Hallmark, is actually an interesting historical piece.
Right.
And she returned to Showtime later in the 2000s with this one movie called Behind the Red Door, which was basically, once again, she just picked something that would be just as good if it were a stage play and makes it very somewhat theatrical. This was way more theatrical than Losing Chase. Like, it has her as a accepting sister who's concerned about her gay brother, who's played by Kiefer Sutherland. This was when he had just made a comeback with 24.
Yeah.
Both she and her next door neighbor, Stalker Channing, are just basically just concerned. You're like, hey, he's succumbing to his disease with AIDS pretty soon. He's very hard to understand. And I actually, this was like the first role where I actually like first paid attention to her as an actress. I was like, this is an uncanny TV movie. And then she's, you know, not just everyone could play this. You know, if it was anyone else, like, I don't know, a Julia Roberts type, they would want the movie to be just as much about them as it is about the other person. Instead,
yes,
again, she's a helper. She's an ensemble person. So
right.
you totally believed, hey, you know, if I had a stuck up brother who was dying slowly and difficult to talk to, you know, she just had the right amount of determination and frustration. He's like, I want to help you, but you're not helping me help you.
Right.
What can I do to make your passage into heaven bearable? You know?
Right. Well, man, Cam, you're putting all these movies on my radar now, and it's like, it's I'm going to keep going on this Kira Sedgwick journey. What I wanted to say too, though, it's interesting that you brought up the episodes and things that she's directed for television, because some of that stuff, you know, you talked about how she creates sort of a community on set, and she likes to work with her family because, like, she makes it comfortable and wants it to be comfortable when she does it. That's kind of what she talked about in my interview, but it's also interesting, like, when she directs a show like Ray Donovan, that gives me hope, because Space Oddity, it's more of a romance. It's more about family coming together. It's like, I want her to now, like, venture off into different genres. I want her to do, you know, action. I want her to do horror movies. And I think, like, she's acted in them before. I don't see why she couldn't get the job done.
It'd be a cool scream queen, or, you know, villain even. There's a few other nominations I'll throw out there. She is also in this other obscure TV drama, Cave Dweller, as well as she's with Stallone, Thomas Jane, Danny Trejo, and this other, this is as close as she got to Tarantino, other than villains. It's called Reach Me.
Okay.
She played and basically, a lot of critics hated this.
I saw it. I saw it available on Prime. I didn't see the movie, but I saw that it was available on Amazon.
It's a like it or hate it, but I remember when I saw it, I was like, hey, regardless of what I think of this, this is not a 20 out of 100,
right?
Compared to other movies, which have, you know, annoying, you know, sound and video problems and just become confusing. So it was cool to see that hey, you know, she's playing an ex-con, all these other people are playing people trying to look for something inspiring in their lives now that they're, you know, out of work, having trouble. And all together, just very intriguing. And
the cast list is like a mile long too.
Yeah. Like ginormous. She also did this movie where she played a hit woman called Montana. And I take it back. That was definitely Tarantino inspired. Like, yeah. Robbie Coltrane, John Ritter, of all people. It was surprisingly very action-packed and very witty. She's done some other dramas like The Low Life and I can't speak today, but it's just like you say, What's Cooking? Yes, now that is definitely essential. Like to play offside Mercedes Rahl and Alfre Woodard and just, again, be dynamic best friends and just play around with the wordplay. I think that's just it too. I think that is her main draw. She doesn't overthink this whole process because you hear so many other people who you either love or hate
right.
who have a bad record of just constantly arguing with the director or trying to talk smack to the producer, say, you're the money man, I'm in charge of this.
Yeah.
And I think she's all about what can I do?
I believe the industry people call that being difficult.
Yes. I'm sugarcoating it, but yeah. Look, she just comes off as the type, she wants to make this explode off the page.
Yeah.
And just be dynamic, not be even cliche, kind of find a way to make it be uncanny. Like, because you'll see so many other people who you'll be like, I love them. But, you know, once Blockbuster exploded and started even premiering certain movies, like I would watch some of those and it would be the same process every time where I'd see it. I'd be kind of disappointed. I'd be like, that's very dramatic. I'm not still unsure why this particular actor, you know, and then you would see the special feature after the fact and be like, okay, now I understand better, like why John Cusack or Forrest Whitaker took this, but right. I can't say I can recommend the movie. It was confusing, but well intended. So
yeah,
kudos to her for just picking, like you say, mostly just solid, relevant blockbusters and indie fare. And I'm looking forward to watching Space Oddity. I can't wait to see this now that you piped it up for me.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope I don't hype it up too much, but it is really this gentle movie, you know, about
gentle.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's about this brother who, about the son of the family who he basically has his sights set on going to Mars. And he tells
everyone to do that growing up.
And he tells everybody in his family that he's going to Mars and that he's been accepted to this program with a person he's been talking to online about going, being the first person to go to Mars. And in this process, he becomes sort of a celebrity of the town. The town starts doing a news report on him going to Mars and all of these things. And his family is like saying to him, like, you're not really going to Mars. That's not possible. And there's a woman who he becomes involved with, who he basically talks to about life insurance because he's going to Mars, and they become sort of romantically involved. And in this process, it becomes opened up to us. Like, we know from the get-go that there's something that happened in this family dynamic. There's something that fractured his connection with his dad and fractured his sort of relationship with his sister in the movie. And his dad is played by Kevin Bacon.
Right.
And we eventually find out, I don't think it's not a spoiler, but we eventually find out that his twin brother had died in like a car accident. And so when we find that out, all of these things start to come into, you know, understanding of why he wants to get away, why he's willing to sort of push his emotions to the back and not handle that struggle with that loss. And, you know, it has a really beautiful arc of him connecting with this woman played by Alexandra Shipp. And the lead actor is Kyle Allen. He's really, you know, good looking dude. He's really cool. And his performance is good. And, Yeah, she directs the hell out of it. It's a throw, like I said, it's a throwback, but it's a really nice movie, and you could do a lot worse, I guess. Maybe that's not a glowing review, but it's like, it's the type of movie that I easily recommend, and I honestly don't think we get enough of.
It's just solid, and the right kind of how to play it safe while also taking a partial risk. That's cool, and
yeah,
I think you just found out the key word. She's all about understanding,
right?
Because there's so many other actors who they'll explain the role, and you'll be like, "I didn't get that at all."
Yeah.
I'm a dense guy. I've read Shakespeare. I've seen live stand-up. I've seen all kinds of movies. So yeah, when someone actually just ignites, like you say, like, and I'm all for it. Even if the movie's meh, you know, I know it's more powerful than I'm giving it credit for. If I'm still thinking about it, and it's not, oh, what would I have changed or done to make it better? You know, if it's
right,
this happened and that happened, and man, I got to see this again.
Right.
That's cool. But like you say, it's like that. That's cool to, because not every indie film can be more than just an ego-headed piece. So that's cool that it just blended together and it didn't feel like just garbage.
Right. Yeah. And I think, like, you know, my mom always, you know, when I talk to my mom on the phone, she's always asking me, what movies can you recommend to my uncle, or what movies can I recommend to her? And most of the time I find myself saying, like, I'm not going to recommend Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, or I'm not going to recommend Fast X to my uncle. He doesn't want to see that. So it's like, when we get a movie like Space Oddity, I think that that's important. I think, like, those movies belong to be in the theater, which I think this one, you know, Space Oddity only had a very brief run. I don't think it had a very successful run by any stretch of the way, but like, those are the kind of movies that we need the older audiences to get out and see, but we also need to tell our audiences about them, because we need to get the word out, and these movies deserve attention that way. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times today, what's offered to us at the movie theater is not as easily accessible, right, for people who are in their 50s and up.
No.
You unfortunately have, like we talked about it with streaming, you unfortunately have to do a lot of searching, or as we do as film critics, we keep our ears to the ground of what movies are coming up and what's, you know, what's coming down the pipeline of the year. And
right.
you know what I mean? And like, the common moviegoer and a person who is more of in for more adult movies or movies that don't involve comic books or spandex, I think movies like Space Oddity are important. You know, we got to tell people about them. And this is definitely one that I hope more people will seek out.
Looking forward to the, after you naturally hyped it up. And I think that's just it too. We need natural hype as opposed to so hyped up to where I've given the whole thing away for you. It has zero impact now that you've seen it.
Right.
To analyze it. So this has been a delight. This hour has flown. Like, no tomorrow.
Yeah. It's been great.
Anytime. What can we look forward from you, especially with those heist movies? There's always some gem that just comes out of no stage right, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So our episode for Nine Queens comes out tomorrow. And then on amovieguy.com, I've got reviews for Fast X, and I've got reviews for A.V. Rockwell's film 1001, which was a big winner at the Sundance Film Festival and is available on Peacock this weekend. I do want to hype it up. I interviewed Rick Roman Waugh, whose new film Can't Hunger is coming out next week. And that interview, I feel like, was really good and went really well. And he is a fascinating guy. He was a former stuntman turned director.
Mm-hmm.
And I think audiences are going to be surprised by Kandahar, but I also think I want, you know, to let people know that he talks a little bit about the cliffhanger movie that he's been attached to with Sylvester Stallone. So I think he's got a lot of cool things coming up, and you can get that always on amovieguy.com.
Sweet.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I will check out that interview, and I can't wait to see Kundan Nar. I need a good political action filler.
Yes. Very.
An excuse to talk about harsh truths in third world countries while also giving an excuse for Gerard Butler to kick some ass. So, yeah.
That you have hit the nail on the head without even seeing the movie. So if that's what you're wanting, that's typically what you're going to be getting out of this.
Something like Homeland or The Kingdom. I'm there.
There you go. Awesome.
All right. Well, Godspeed to you, my dude. And let's stay in touch.
Yeah. Thanks, Cam. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on your show, and look forward to doing it again next time.
Anytime. All right.
Well, All right, buddy.
Godspeed.
Yep. Take care. Oh, Cam.
Yes.
Can before we go, can I plug my
please?
You can edit this. I definitely want to plug my Twitter, which is @Leo's a movie guy. And then my Instagram is just @a movie guy. And then you can find me on Facebook and Letterboxd as well. I'm on there, Leo. And
give them a suggestion, guys. Give them an obscure heist movie like The Money Movers or something.
There you go. Yeah. And yeah, so, you know, like and subscribe, obviously, to my YouTube page and follow me on Twitter. Follow me on
Patreon when the time comes, guys.
Yeah, maybe. Someday, you know, we've talked about it.
Put some money in his pocket.
Exactly. But again, thank you, Cam, for letting me be on the show.
1000%, dude. This was so great.
All right. You have a good one.
I try. Right.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.